Take a network break, get a virtual donut, and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. We've got stories on Juniper, HPE, a bunch of financial results, and much more. We're sponsored today by Palo Alto Networks. They're excited to introduce a fundamentally new approach to cloud-delivered security with Prisma Access 2.0. You can find out more at the upcoming Prisma Access 2.0 launch event on March 17th, 10 a.m. Pacific. You'll also hear about the latest industry trends and customer perspectives from industry leaders. You can register at start.paloaltonetworks.com/prisma-access-2-launch. And you can find that link in the show notes for episode 322 of Network Break. Stay tuned after the news. We got a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Aruba Edge Connect SD-WAN customer Ford Harrison. They're a law firm. They're using SD-WAN to enable their remote work strategy and boost performance of critical apps. Last but not least, sign up for our weekly free newsletter, the Human Infrastructure Newsletter. We collect the best tech blogs from around the web, interesting community projects and videos, some jokes, and an essay from the Packet Pushers every issue. Sign up at packetpushers.net/newsletter. All right, Greg, let's jump into it. We have a quick FU from a listener. Last week, we talked about DNS security provider Quad9 relocating its HQ to Switzerland. That also spurred a brief conversation about DNS over HTTPS or DOE, which prompted a response from Brian Jemis.
Yeah, he's basically highlighting that he agrees that it's important to acknowledge the risks of a highly centralized DNS over HTTPS providers because they get to collect all of the DNS lookup data. Mm-hmm. And the benefits of adopting DNSSEC, because I've been highlighting that for a while. DNS over HTTPS solves the first mile, but it doesn't actually solve the spoofing, domain spoofing problem. And there's a whole integrity issue behind that. So I do think we need to keep working on DNSSEC. And then, of course, the news that ISC is bringing DOH support into Bind9 was something he hadn't heard about, so he was pleased to hear about that. So thanks for contacting us, Brian. It's always good to hear from you. And if you've got some follow-up or any FU you want to pass on to us, head on over to packetpushers.net/FU. There's a little webpage there where you can leave the question. You don't have to give us your private information or tell us who you are. Just tell us what you want to know, what you want to say.
We're happy to keep you perfectly anonymous. And yeah, we'll bring it on the show.
Yeah, lots of people can't share their personal details or don't want to, and that's perfectly right, okay and acceptable. Just leave some details there for us, and then we'll get back to you and cover it on the show as someone anonymous. We'll take it from there.
All right, let's dive into the news. Juniper made several announcements this week. First, if you'll recall, back in October, they acquired a company called 128 Technology for $450 million. 128 Technology is now Juniper's enterprise SD-WAN play. And this week, Juniper announced that it's tying 128 Technology into its Mist AI engine, meaning that telemetry from the 128 Tech appliances will be analyzed by the Mist AI for things like anomaly detection and providing deeper visibility into device and network performance.
Yeah, so this is good news, I think, in the way that Juniper had done the previous SD-WAN under the Contrail banner was it was very much like an IPsec DM VPN low flow balancing across links. But it didn't kind of go that step further in the SD-WAN to do dynamic load balancing per packet or per application. And some of the identification or the application recognition stuff didn't have the same feature parity of what we've seen from other SD-WAN companies. I think we talked about that before. We weren't entirely happy with Contrail's SD-WAN solution.
I mean, I really think Juniper sort of missed the SD-WAN market with its first go-around with Contrail. I think their idea was to sell Contrail to service providers, and then the service providers would in turn sell SD-WAN services to customers. Yes. That never really panned out.
No, it was more of what I now think of as old Juniper, in that old Juniper was still bound to the MPLS legacy routing. The only source of truth shall be BGP, you know.
Right.
And everything's got to have an MPLS tag or it can't be real. And it's weird how the true faith has suddenly switched from BGP and MPLS to AI ops, though, isn't it?
Mist is now Juniper and Juniper is now Mist, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really interesting because the 128 technology is really interesting in the point of view that the way that it does its SD-WAN is really just an incredibly simple idea. It's a recognition of a different way of going about things. I don't think we'll cover it here today, but if you go out and read up on how the technology works, it's fundamentally about mapping source IP, source port to destination IP, destination port, and then doing some very simple encryption in the flow path. Mm-hmm. And because of SDN, you can actually track all of those things. And that's it, right? You don't need a whole bunch of tricky-dicky, you know, Lisp stuff if you're just going to use straight up SDN. So I think the 128 technology is going to be a real boost for Juniper, a much simpler SD-WAN, and also much better prepared to implement the security functions that people now come as default. And then increasingly, I also think a much better remote access or distributed work client. So when Juniper gets back to the edge of the network where the users are, and that is in the client, in the handset. So many networking companies still believe the router or the SD-WAN appliance or the switch is the edge of the network. And that's not true anymore. In the data center, the edge is the smart NIC and the virtual switch. And increasingly, my belief is that we'll see the edge of the network move out from the network, from the router, from a virtual or physical router, right into the handset itself. And the networking companies will have VPN clients or software-defined perimeter clients handling distributed work applications right out in the edge node. And the 128 technology is almost perfect for that, I feel.
It's an interesting technology. We've written about it a lot on Packet Pushers. If you just go to packetpushers.net and search 128 technology, there's a ton of write-ups that you and me and Ethan have all done. I think it's just good for Juniper to have a very well-defined SD-WAN strategy that sort of follows along the model that most enterprise customers are comfortable with and know. Like, I buy the appliance, I put it in my branch offices, I've got a controller, I set up my policies, and off I go. It's a very good, clean, simple story for Juniper to tell, and now they can finally start competing against the Ciscos, the Arubas, everybody else who's really run with this.
Yeah, well, let's keep going through the other two, then we can wrap up with, you know, the rest of the transition that seems to go on at Juniper.
Yeah, okay, so two other announcements this week. Juniper announced its SRX security gateways will now be onboarded and configured using the Mist AI. There's that Mist again. As we mentioned, Juniper's been aggressively integrating enterprise products with Mist. This is the latest tie-in. So the Mist AI cloud is going to be the management interface for the XRS gateways going forward. And third, Juniper announced a new campus switch line, the EX4400 line. It's a 1RU switch form factor, and models can support from 1 to 10 gig ports or up to 48 1 gig ports. It's got all kinds of features, including EVPN, VXLAN, and you can put up to 10 members into a virtual chassis.
And so I seem to recall that it was about 14, 18 months ago, I was highlighting that Juniper was switching back its focus to the enterprise as the service provider market was saturated. And it needed to grow and it needed to get into the come back to the enterprise. And then we questioned whether Juniper could do this. And I look at these moves. So the SRX now has an SDN solution through the Mist AI and AI Ops. So the security firewall, putting Juniper on a roughly equal footing with, say, Palo Alto and Fortinet, I want to say.
Getting there, yeah, I would say.
Yeah, in that direction. So they've got the, you know, Palo Alto and Fortinet have the SD-WAN chomping away at the enterprise WAN, if you like, you know,
right,
and locking Juniper out because its routers are just not relevant in that. Once you've got an SD-WAN appliance, you don't need a router and you don't care about MPLS anymore. And so this Juniper does have to get into this aggressively. And so this makes sense, getting the security functions. I suspect the SRX will become more of the SD-WAN rather than SD-WAN appliances per se. So snapping that into Mist AI makes very good sense. And then extending the campus stuff here with the EX4400. Now, one of the things that's particularly interested here is the EX4400 is pitched as a wired wireless. Of course, the Mist AI acquisition came in as part of the, as a wireless product first. Is that, if I remember right?
Yeah.
So the idea that the campus is still getting momentum is good because I think it's a big market. There are people still building campuses, although not the way that they used to. But what is unique is Juniper's using EVPN VXLAN, or a standards-based methodology to create the microsegments. And I want to come highlight this compared to Cisco's approach of using Lisp. And I think I've said before that I understand why Cisco chose Lisp. It was a technology that let their legacy hardware go forward. But I don't think it matters because it's much cheaper to use a bigger chip that's got more stuff on it. Like, bet on the silicon getting better than waiting, than going and adopting a whole new set networking technology. Because now Cisco's got this problem where the Lisp is over here in the campus and it's isolated, legacy, right? Sure, you can be using VXLAN in the campus using Lisp to create the overlay, but now you've got to map the Lisp into the EVPN in the data center, and then you've got to map it into what's going on in the WAN. And I think Cisco's got a much tougher problem going forward if it when it tries to unify. I think it will be forced to unify, whereas Juniper's saying, well, just use EVPN and VXLAN for that campus overlay, and boom, away we go. And we'll get some bigger hardware, and the hardware ramps faster than the software can. So I think this makes sense.
Juniper also made it clear that they're winning deals with Mist on the wireless side, and that helps them to pull through access switching deals on the wired side as well. So that's part and parcel of this, that whole Mist tie-up as well.
Well, it's that ops tie-up, you know, this idea that the AI stuff is saying, oh, hi there, Mr. Engineer, you've got a problem with your Wi-Fi over here. Or, customer, we're seeing problems with DNS lookups. You know, it's not the network, it's the DNS. It would be the classic line that we would say. And that sort of AI ops can say, oh, hang on, we're looking and we're seeing from the telemetry data coming out of your switches that you've got a DNS lookup problem. It's not the Wi-Fi that's broken. It's not the campus LAN that's broken. It's your DNS. Go and fix that. You know, do you want us to help you with that? And it even they even have articles. Well, I don't want to overdate. We don't have a lot of time today, but they're sort of belaboring the point that you can have like spoken casual conversations where you actually type in a question and Marvin, who's the persona behind Mist AI, will come back and say, you should be looking at this or thinking about this. And I think that is a real winner. If you've got that working for you in the campus, that's going to stick. Customers are going, that's a land and expand strategy that really works.
Yeah, quick correction, it's the Marvis virtual assistant, and you can do things like natural language queries like, hey, why was this Teams call bad this morning? That's what they're touting as part of that.
Again, that's easy. I can tell you that. That's because Microsoft Teams sucks. What was the question?
Yeah. We don't need fancy algorithms for that, yes.
No, that's a given.
In any case, lots of news from Juniper, and I think there's going to be more. They hinted in a briefing I had that more is coming, so stay tuned. But let's move on. HPE, they have acquired Cloud Physics. This is a SaaS company that tries to help companies optimize their spending in the data center and in the cloud.
Yeah, so the curious thing about this, I wouldn't normally bother with this idea that companies like HPE, Cisco, IBM, Dell, VMware acquire companies who can do billing management or spend management in the cloud. They call it optimized spending, but it's really about spend management. And it's a realization of the fact that when you go into the clouds, those products are so proprietary and so arcane that developers just go out there and start spinning up services, and then suddenly you've got this out of control spending. There's no controls and checks, and you need to have either a bunch of people or a bunch of people with tools. And as people are discovering in the cloud that all of a sudden they're spending a vast amount of resources just tracking where the cost is, you know, where the spend is going and why and what's its purpose. I also note that HPE has made multiple acquisitions in this space. The last round was around 2016, 2017. Do you remember those rounds?
Yeah, I do remember talking about a similar acquisition.
Yeah, there was one like Cloud Technology Partners and stuff like that. I think this one's different in that we're in a different time and a different space. The last time they did it, I had the opinion that HPE was more like acquiring these cloud consulting companies who could advise you on where your spend was going in the cloud, but really the goal was to try and sell you more stuff on premises. That was back in 2017. You know what I mean? Like I'm sure that with customers, they were doing the best thing, right? But I think collectively, what HPE was looking for was for these cloud services, you know, the spend management stuff was basically to recommend that you should be on premises, not off premises. I think now it's much more different.
Yeah. And I mean, frankly, as we've heard, cloud costs can surprise folks because sometimes things get spun up and then never used, or they run and they're oversized or whatever. And so having some kind of optimization strategy makes sense. And HP, I think in the announcement also mentioned that, you know, VARs and resellers and managed services customers can use this with their clients to provide that sort of extra high touch value add.
Yeah. Well, the fun thing about this is nobody ever stands up at, you know, at a big conference or in a public forum and says, oh, yeah, we moved to the cloud, but it really sucked because our cost blew out by 300%. Right? Nobody stands up on stage and says that. But that's actually the reality is what actually happens is cloud does not cost less. It costs a lot more.
Yep.
And quite often you might be spending whatever you spent before, you're now spending 200% more in the cloud, and you're also spending a lot more on headcount to track it. Just to do billing management. So this is a team. We'll wait for a lot more of this. There'll be a lot more of this coming.
Yeah. All right. Links in the show notes if you want to find out more. We'll move on. The Register reports on eye-watering sums that big U.S. telcos are spending on new spectrum licenses to support their 5G rollouts. The Federal Communications Commission just concluded a spectrum auction that netted $81 billion in license fees. And the breakdowns are Verizon spent $45 billion for licenses, AT&T spent $23 billion, and T-Mobile spent $9.3 billion.
Now, there's two sides to this. One way is, of course, you know, the U.S. government's going to be pretty pleased that it managed to pull off $81 billion, and the people in the FCC made a whole bunch of money and can justify their existence, and you know, they fulfilled their purpose. The flip side of this is that all of that money that the telcos have just handed over for the licenses now have to be recovered from the customers in the US. That is something I'm sort of torn between wanting to say, like, this is bad for customers because now they have to repay that money in their billing.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, the US government has got that money and can potentially do some good with it by moving that money to support telecommunications in areas where bandwidth is poor or limited.
Yes.
So it's hard to say. There are some countries around the world who just say, here's the licenses, and the companies come and apply. There's a review process, and then the licenses are handed out free of charge. And there are other countries, like here in the UK, they try to stop them from overbidding, if that makes sense.
Ah.
The goal here isn't so much to maximize the revenue opportunity, but to find out who's going to maximize the usage. So here, the bandwidth is a limited resource. We want to make sure it gets used.
Who's going to be a good steward of that bandwidth?
Yeah, they want to make sure that the companies are going to use it, not just buy it to speculatively sell it up or to create a monopoly out of owning the bandwidth. And so this is this me before we, business before society, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you could have an interesting debate that I'm not going to have here, but that's just some thoughts that I wanted to throw out there. I could see two sides of the argument here. Great news for the FCC and its support for people with poor bandwidth. On the other hand, consumers now have to pay the $81 billion to these companies who paid licenses for these bandwidth.
Yeah, but you'll get 5G in return, and won't it be worth it?
Highly unlikely, but okay.
I hope the sarcasm came through on that question. All right. And check out the Registrar. It's really good. It also gives some background on the spectrum. This had been allocated originally to satellite communications providers. And so as part of the deal, the telcos are paying fees to the satellite communications providers to vacate that spectrum. So check out the piece. It's interesting.
Oh, yeah. There was a big kerfuffle there around the military. Some of that spectrum was being used by the military for certain types of things, and they all got very bent out of shape around the whole thing. But yeah, not an easy discussion, that one, I think.
Yeah. All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Palo Alto Networks. Enterprises are adopting a hybrid cloud strategy to meet the demands of remote work now more than ever. Unfortunately, legacy secure access solutions leave remote workforces vulnerable to threats. Palo Alto Networks is excited to introduce a fundamentally new approach with Prisma Access 2.0 as the industry's only complete cloud-delivered security platform. Provides more security coverage than any other solution, and you can find out more about the upcoming Prisma Access 2.0 launch event taking place March 17th, 10 a.m. Pacific. You'll also hear about the latest industry trends and customer perspectives from industry leaders, so don't settle for incomplete security. Learn about Palo Alto Networks' Prisma Access 2.0, the industry's only complete cloud-delivered security platform. Again, Wednesday, March 17th, 10 a.m. Pacific. You can register at start.paloaltonetworks.com/prisma-access-2. That's the number 2. /launch. And again, the link is in the show notes for Network Break 322.
Yeah. If you're an architect or a designer and you're in the process of evaluating vendors and their strategies around this sort of stuff, Prisma is going to be the big one for Palo Alto. So it might be worth sort of tracking what's happening in the Prisma space, because they're sort of relaunching the Prisma Access capability, that integrated security capability, and they're also folding in the CloudGenix acquisition in there as well.
Yeah, a lot happening in there. So yeah, if you are in the SASE or cloud security market, probably worth checking out. All right, back to the news. VMware has announced the availability of Photon OS version 4.0. The Photon OS is a Linux container host that VMware has optimized for vSphere and cloud deployments.
Yeah, this is a little bit not something we normally talk about. We don't get this much in the weeds with VMware, but what's interesting about this is that Photon OS is a Linux distribution, which is basically built to be the minimal viable Linux that you can then use to run containers. Uh-huh. So if you want to have VMware or some other app coming on board, the idea is that this is a pre-prepared, open source, openly available to access tool that you can run, so that you can run containers on top of it using your preferred platform. Now, whether it's Azure or GCE or Elastic,
Amazon Elastic,
I'm not 100% sure how all this goes together. I'm not really an expert in this area, but the thing that I really liked about it is they were making a big deal about it being for 5G RAN, and we've talked before about how VMware is really keen to see that 5G edge networking go its way. It doesn't want it doesn't want to see Linux take over that. It wants to use the VMware control plane, that the telcos would be using VMware to run the radio access network, and all the VMs would be there providing all the routers and RAN function, radio processing, and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, there's also a real-time version of this Photon OS. Now, that's not something I've seen before, the idea that this underlay could actually run real-time. So if you're running a application which has to run real-time, that has to mean it has to click on the text. It can't just be best effort or run asynchronously. It has to run synchronously. There's a version of this Photon OS that would work for you. And there are certain times when that is a need. Now, that is not something that historically open source has been able to address. Open source is not normally that capable in that area and requires a certain coding discipline to make that happen. So I thought it was interesting. And if you're into that sort of space, maybe it's worth referring to the notes and getting up to speed on the latest announcement and what a real-time operating system looks like.
All right, links in the show notes.
You know, if you want it, you need it.
That's how it goes. Yeah. All right, we got some financial results to go through. We'll start off with SolarWinds. They just reported their Q4 results. The company had revenues of $265 million, up 7.2%, and net income of $132.7 million.
Yeah, I think the interesting part about SolarWinds is, of course, the breach that they had last year, SolariGate. This week, they've actually been up in front of two committees in the U.S. political system, I think, Congress committees or something.
Yep.
And saying, you know, just leave us alone. We want to just make money. We're a company. It's not our fault. The Russians got us, you know, whatever, making up whatever it is that they think they can wiggle out of it.
Sure.
What's interesting here is that it's the breach was actually announced in late mid-December or so, and these financial results don't really embrace that period. So right. My initial reaction was, security doesn't matter. You know, their results are up. They had Q4 revenues up 72%. Net income was up. They beat all of the expectations and share price popped. But the flip side is that the breach hasn't really impacted that because it didn't come until much later.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, I think Q1 and Q2 of next year will get, I think, a more fuller story of what kind of financial impact the breach has on SolarWinds. These results were probably more or less baked in at when the breach was announced.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we'll find out, does software, does security matter? Something to look forward to. I will say in the their official announcement, the CEO is sort of, I think, playing pretty well the cards he's got. He's thanking his employees and customers, kind of try to humanize the company, like, we're all just people doing our best. And then he cited nation-state level cyber operations, so implying that, you know, this one little modestly sized software company is no match for, you know, this targeted action by a nation-state. So in terms of damage management, it seems like he's doing the best he can. I don't necessarily agree with that statement, but he's trying.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, moving on with the other results. VMware, they announced their Q4 and fiscal year 2021 results. Their fourth quarter revenues were $3.3 billion, up 7% over last year, and a net income of $791 million. For the full year, VMware had revenues of $11.8 billion, up 9% year over year, and a net income of $2.1 billion. So I will note that this is VMware's first financial statement since the departure of Pat Gelsinger to Intel. There's still no word on a new CEO. VMware's CFO is currently serving as acting CEO until a formal replacement is announced. But it seems like, you know, Gelsinger sort of left the company in a decent position, and it's up to them to continue executing.
Yeah, well, you know, VMware's got tremendous momentum. It's hard to imagine that VMware's results would be anything but continuing along the path. Genuinely, I think it will take a while for things to fail one way or the other. And
it's a sunny outlook.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the management stack there ran very deep, and they did a whole bunch of stuff to keep the company on track. Pat Gelsinger has always been one to sort of share the things around. He's never been, although there's a lot of CEO magic and mystical magic that sort of goes on there. Not in this particular case, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think he's, you know, not one to sort of draw the spotlight to himself. He tends to share the glory, which is not always what happens with top executives.
Yeah, a lot of executives sort of, you know, it's all me and I'm the center and micromanage. I certainly had the impression that Gelsinger was, you know, very carefully involved and very deep into all the technologies that were going on. But the flip side was, you know, his leaving will leave, make a long-term dent in the company. And so it's really going to take a couple of quarters to see if VMware, and it is possible for VMware to lose its way. It's certainly at a key point where its success has been built on something, and where the industry is going forward, it's not clear that VMware will be able to follow it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why they're really doubling down on their Tanzu strategy, which is essentially their effort to integrate containers and Kubernetes into vSphere so that VMware can mm-hmm. continue to serve as that infrastructure and policy layer, even as folks move to microservices and cloud native. We'll see if this strategy is the right one, but at least they have a direction and they can move forward with it.
Mm-hmm, for sure, yeah.
VMware competitor Nutanix released their Q2 financial results. The company posted revenues of $346.4 million, just a hair lower than this time last year, and they had operating expenses of $431 million. So doing the math, it's still spending more than it's earning.
Yeah, well, I've been a little critical on Nutanix in the past and sort of highlighting the fact that it's still making substantial losses and still not able to show a path to profitability over time. They are definitely turning it around. And they're now talking about a gross margin, which has grown from 60% in 2017 to 80%, which is about where they need to be. That is the industry standard. Uh-huh. And, but I still can't, I mean, they've done a great job of turning it around, getting the money. They've transitioned the CEO. You know, the founder CEO is now out. There's a more business-oriented CEO coming in. But when you go and read the financial results, they talk about this thing a lot called ACV, which is actual contract value billings. Uh-huh. And this is something that they've arbitrarily made up as a measure of business success.
Yes.
And you might be surprised to find that it shows that everything's going just hunky-dory.
True. Yes, exactly. Yes. When you have to put footnotes on your financial reporting, that's always a little bit of a flag.
And it's not GAAP, right? So it's not generally accepted accounting.
There's no, it's not. Doing just them saying, here's a way to look at it that makes us look good.
Right. And so there's a few things there. I was looking at what this means and I read into some of their financial stuff. They're actually, if you buy a 1, 3, or 5 year license subscription from Nutanix, then they actually book all that revenue up front as an upfront sale. Even though it comes in over the 5 years, they actually book it as a backfill. Does that make sense? Uh-huh. Yeah. And so that's kind of weird because Cisco doesn't. And other companies don't. You don't want to book that. You actually want to recognize that in the years to follow. So there is some, it's just a sign. There's a whole bunch of other little signs in amongst there that Nutanix is doing some very clever accounting to present the best possible image. And maybe it's still got a lot of work to do. I guess we'll just have to keep tracking it as time goes forward.
That's right. Link in the show notes if you want to look at it for yourself. We're going to conclude with a couple of stories on the escalating battle between browser privacy and online tracking. First, Firefox announced a new feature called Total Cookie Protection. Essentially, it restricts cookies that a site drops onto a browser into its own container to prevent any data on that cookie being shared with third parties. But at the same time, Greg, you found a story in Hacker News reporting on research that shows that marketers are trying to evade privacy controls through techniques like CNAME cloaking to try to disguise third-party cookies.
Yeah, this is, we have a bit of a thing about privacy here from two reasons. There's personal privacy and there's also corporate privacy, which I think both matter more than most people understand. And the interesting part is that we talked about in the past, Safari's now blocking off third-party cookie tracking so that, you know, if Facebook lays a cookie down because you're on Facebook and then you go over to a shopping website, that site can't read the cookie and then report back to Facebook that you were there. So uh-huh. This is that third-party cookie thing. And that's what ad tracking companies or dynamic ad harvesting companies have been doing. If you go to any website on the web, they read the cookie that was there and then they know that you went to this website and then to this website, you went to this clothes site, you went to this food site, you went to this site. Oh, hang on, you're looking for beds. All right. And you buy this sort of food. Well, we can tell something about you.
Right.
And so Safari takes the view that most people don't understand that and that we want to be protected against that to some extent. People don't expect that level of privacy breach.
Right.
And when they find out about it, they tend to get upset. And so Firefox this week implemented ETP strict mode that places the website cookies into isolation. That is, if you place a cookie, even if it's a Facebook cookie or a Google cookie, it sits in lockstep with the website that went there. So if you went to packetpushers.net, all the cookies that we would lock can't be accessed by the web browser unless you're on packetpushers.net.
Right.
Well, that's a great feature. All of a sudden, third-party tracking goes away. And that's sort of what people expect. They don't mind sharing their data with packet pushers because you were at packet pushers. But when you then go off to, you know, some sort of shopping site, you don't expect them to go, oh, look, I can see you're at packet pushers. Well, I can interpret something about you. Right?
That's exactly.
But the disadvantage here is that the online tracking companies have now switched to a thing called CNAME cloaking technique, which is where they get the sites to put in a CNAME record, which then points to their ad tracking technology. The good news here is that this is not as effective. It's not as universal. So only about 10% of the top 1,000 websites have implemented this. But if you are a network engineer and you're working on the user tracking and user stuff, you're going to need to look into this and make sense of it, because it's going to change your security and the data leakage. Because if, as I've said before, people can track your staff as they move around online.
That's right. Yeah. So again, links in the show notes if you want to dive into the details. The Firefox blog is very good, very clear, and the Hacker News story. It's just more evidence that this is a game of cat and mouse. And I don't really know who's winning at this point. Maybe and who is the cat and who is the mouse either way. But
yep.
Good stuff. So go check it out. That does wrap up our news. Please stay tuned for a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation on the Aruba EdgeConnect SD-WAN. We're talking to the law firm Ford Harrison about how they're using SD-WAN to support remote workers and boost app performance. That's starting right now. Welcome to the Tech Bytes podcast. We're sponsored by Silver Peak, and we're talking about an SD-WAN deployment with Scott Shaw. He's the Chief Technology Officer at Ford Harrison LLP. This is a labor and employment law firm with 25 offices across the U.S. Scott, welcome to the podcast. Can you give us a brief background on the role that the WAN plays in supporting the law firm?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, we have 25 offices spread across the United States, which is difficult in some respects getting our attorneys to act as one law firm since they are so spread out geographically. So that's a challenge for us. One thing we pride ourselves on is client service and presenting a unified and consistent experience for all of our clients is important. Mm-hmm. So the role the WAN plays in that is really fundamental in tying all of those people and offices together.
So we're talking about, I'm guessing, applications like voice, email, whatever legal applications you use?
Yeah, so in the legal world, of course, our product is advice and documents. Yeah. So essentially communication. So being able to talk on the phone, exchange emails, produce documents, those are pretty key fundamentals of our business.
Right, okay.
What about security? Because legal firms have a strong obligation to maintain the privacy and the security of the documents of their clients, you know, legal privilege and all that sort of stuff. Is that a big consideration here?
That is an understatement. That is a huge consideration always. I just read about yet another pretty major law firm this morning that had an incident. We don't like to say breach anymore. We call them incidents. So yes, that's always top of mind.
I imagine you're reading that and going, thank goodness that's not me.
Every time. Yes, every time. Quick scan through the article, no mention of my firm, then I read it.
Okay, so the WAN needs to be up and running. Applications need to be performant. Before you moved to SD-WAN, what kind of technical challenges were you facing?
The biggest challenge we had pre-SD-WAN was, I would say, reliability. So we had a single carrier MPLS network connecting all of those offices together. Mm-hmm. And as carriers are wont to do, we sort of rode the waves of a couple different mergers. And anyone that's been through a merger while they're with their carrier knows that there are going to be some outages as they combine those networks. And we had some problems because we only had a single carrier. So we had some reliability issues where offices would go down unexpectedly and not come up in a reasonable amount of time sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And you're fingering directly just having a single supplier for WAN bandwidth was really the core here. You felt that having access to multiple suppliers or diverse ways of accessing the network was a key issue.
Absolutely. Yep. Right. Definitely a key issue.
And I think the challenge there would be is that all you can do is feel really helpless, because all you can do is kick it upstairs. And if they say we're doing the best we can, that's it.
That's exactly right. I didn't have the bat phone to the CEO of our carrier, but I did have an escalation list that I used frequently and liberally. it does help, but you are absolutely at their mercy.
Now, part of an SD-WAN solution is that you usually migrate away from the concept of dedicated bandwidth to public bandwidth. Did you go to using internet, or did you stick with the MPLS but go to just a, you know, like what the telcos call MPLS from their point of view, but shove it down customers' throats? Did you find moving to public bandwidth a worry, or are you using a mix?
I did find, I was concerned. We did, so first of all, yes, we did go to all direct internet connectivity. And yes, I was concerned at the outset. And those concerns, luckily so far, we're a year and a half in now, were really unfounded. We've had no issues.
Okay. And have employees noticed any difference, either for better or for worse?
Employees, you know, we really only get any recognition when things go badly. So I don't get, I'm not getting daily praise phone calls.
Sure. Of course.
But the number of issues have definitely gone down. And I would say our employees definitely noticed. I'll tell you, you know, one of the success stories of 2020 for our firm was our ability to transition to a work from home or work from anywhere scenario really pretty easily and quickly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was due to SD-WAN and the reliability of our users to get to the data that we store in our data center. And it was really highlighted, you know, speaking of calls, I did get some praise calls at that time because we had some managing partners that are friends with other lawyers at other firms, and they talk. And those firms were having real problems transitioning to work from home. They were having real reliability problems. No one anticipated that at a given point in time, 100% of the workforce would be trying to connect remotely all of a sudden. You know, people plan for 30% or 50% or maybe even 70%, right, but not 100%.
So you're using SD-WAN then to turn up home offices for law partners and senior law staff. So your actual network isn't just 25 branches anymore. It's hundreds?
Well, so we do actually have a couple of extra small appliances at some key employees' homes. I hope they're not, I hope other employees aren't listening to this podcast. So yeah, we did extend a few nodes, but the real key was having the data center available.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how SD-WAN affected folks getting access to applications in the data center? Were they like coming into a branch office, like tunneling into a branch office and then heading out to the data center, or how was that working?
So at the beginning, so our remote access scenario uses a remote desktop gateway scenario. So those users at the branch offices would connect remotely to their local office and then connect back to the data center from there.
All right. So you didn't deploy some sort of thin client infrastructure in the data center and then get everybody to migrate away from the way they used to work. They literally connected to their work computers on their desks and continue on. And so the SD-WAN was important there because you're still coming in off the public WAN, people are connecting from the internet, but the actual data issues, privacy issues, and the controls, like your data controls, are still in the office.
Everything was still contained and encapsulated in the office. Absolutely.
That's neat. That would have been,
yeah.
Odd, but like not the way that you would normally, I guess if you had have gone and spoken to a vendor, they would have tried to sell you some sort of thin client or some sort of remote access. And but what you've done there is actually go with the most obvious solution.
Yes. And many vendors did try to sell us virtual desktops and thin clients and the like, which are wonderful. I have no knock against any of those. But in that very quick transition to work from home, the way we did it worked very well for us.
I imagine the work is very document heavy. Are you taking advantage of, I know Silver Peak has some caching capabilities and so on. Is that part of the solution you're using?
So we do not use the caching capabilities, but we take advantage of the business intent overlays. So which in Silver Peak terminology basically is application optimization. So we're able to select ports that we deem high priority and prefer that traffic over, you know, say port 80 traffic. So printing comes last. Yeah, printing comes last. That's right. Yeah. That's right. I've been trying to get rid of those printers for 50 years.
It'll be a few more years before the legal system catches up with no paper. I just like that idea because what you're doing there is basically quality of service. So it's pretty straightforward, picking the apps that get priority and everything else just runs. You're picking out the things that matter and then letting it go. Fairly simple, again, very straightforward type of an idea. When you came to select Silverpeak, this is a question I like to ask, is there's lots of other SD-WAN vendors out there and you evaluated some of the others. What worked for you when you came to the selection process?
So that question, it's a great question. And part of what I needed at that moment in time was simplicity. So the MPLS network with a Cisco router at every site with some fairly complex routing requirements was complicated, and it took a lot of effort to maintain and to expand when we needed to. So we had a full-time Cisco engineer on staff to manage just that network. And what really drew me to Silverpeak was the fact that I could all of a sudden manage the network. Not that I wanted to or had time to, but it didn't require that unique Cisco experience and expertise to manage it. The interface is very simple and easy to use. I can add a business intent overlay myself if I needed to. So a big part of it was the simplicity, the ability for 95% of what we would need done to be run by people that I already had on staff. We wouldn't need a dedicated network engineer.
A lot of what, if I recall from my research into Silverpeak, a lot of it comes out of a lot, just works out of the box. You don't actually have to do a whole lot in a lot of ways because it's sort of pre-configured, dials up, sets itself up, updates itself, knows where some of its base configuration is all done for you. And really, you're just tinkering with the edges.
Absolutely correct. We did a proof of concept with three sites, and literally out of the box, day one, we had connectivity and it worked. And then we could tweak it, as you said, and add some of those features that we were interested in to test. But that was also a big selling point. Getting the proof of concept and seeing that we could have connectivity out of the box was pretty impressive.
So the orchestrator then gives you the visibility. So you could probably even run the SD-WAN from remotely. So you didn't have to go be in the office on a special computer that had access list to permit it. You could just run it from the SD-WAN orchestrator.
Yeah, so they have an on-prem option for orchestrator, and then they have a cloud orchestrator. So the cloud orchestrator does let you manage the network from anywhere.
Right. In the process of retiring, you said you had Cisco routers. Presumably they're retired now.
They're gone.
Right. And does that give you the ROI you need, or was getting rid of the MPLS the ROI?
Both. Just SmartNet alone on the routers almost paid for the SD-WAN hardware. And then getting rid of the MPLS network and being able to use DIA and broadband, which is what we use. Each site has a DIA circuit and a broadband circuit on independent local loops. So that if one goes down, the other should stay up. And that cost reduction was huge as well, while increasing bandwidth. So we got more bandwidth for less monthly recurring costs from our carriers. And then the hardware outlay versus the annual Cisco SmartNet upkeep was almost a wash.
Yeah. Wow. So you basically got ROI in less than a year, what it sounds like, or less probably.
It depends on whether you're talking to me or my CFO to answer that question, but it was either less than a year or 14 months.
Okay. Arguably.
I hope that got you a praise call. So you mentioned 25 offices. I'm presuming you probably don't have IT staff at each one. What was rolling out SD-WAN appliances to each branch like?
That was thanks to an awesome IT team that I have on staff here. So we did travel to each site and put our equipment in, but it was a short trip. It was a short trip to each site. It was a day, and coordinated with the carriers to test and turn up the circuits, and that was it.
So you went with DIA. That's an expensive form of MPLS, but did you go with that for the assurance to get that sort of, I don't just want DSL, I just wanted to have that guaranteed, belts and braces, this really must work type feeling?
Absolutely, yeah, for the stability and the guaranteed bandwidth.
Do you think that'll change over time? Would you go to three broadbands, get multiple broadband providers and consider doing that? Or do you just stay the way it is?
I don't know if you're trying to make me, go gray sooner than I already am. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. I haven't thought that far ahead. I'm still resting on my laurels. But maybe. I could see that.
we don't want to do everything in 1 year. You know, you don't want to overexceed the bonus because they don't pay you more just because you overachieve, right?
That's right. The sweet spot. You got to hit that sweet spot.
Got to keep something back for next year. That's what salespeople do. There's always something else.
Well, that does bring us to the end of our conversation. Thank you, Scott, for joining us. And thanks to Silver Peak for being a sponsor. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.